I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. Department stores have been experiencing disappointing sales in recent months. Macy's, Nordstrom's, and others say they aren't having the foot traffic they expect at this time of year. November and December are key months for retailers, driven largely by the holiday season. What explains this slump, and what are retailers going to do about it? We asked Lindsay Rupp to join us. She writes about retail for Bloomberg News. In fact, joins us from Bloomberg Studios in New York. And Lindsay Rupp, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
Is this a new problem for these big retailers, a longstanding one, an episodic one? What's going on?
Oh, that's a great question. It's been a problem that's been brewing for a while now, I think, especially with the dawn of the internet. You can buy anything you want online, and people do. But, you know, it seems to have really kicked up in the third quarter for retailers. Several retailers, from Urban Outfitters to Nordstrom, have said that their traffic really fell off in the third quarter. And that's a bad sign. That's the fall. That's through about the end of October. And if that doesn't get better during Christmas, that's a big deal.
Are we talking sort of high-end retailers, low-end retailers across the board?
Well, so it seems to be concentrated in sort of the middle levels, the mid-tier, some upper levels, but that might be skewed a little bit by, tourism. So the dollar is really strong. People aren't coming to shop in the U.S. But in the mid-level where you've got your Macy's and Urban Outfitters and Fossil, they're seeing major challenges. They're seeing people just aren't coming into their stores. They're particularly not interested in buying apparel and accessories right now.
Which is really interesting when you think about it. In fact, you had a piece today in the paper about what people or consumers are spending their money on, because clearly with gas prices down, people have a little more expendable or sort of loose change that they can spend it on. What are people buying?
That's right. And employment has been much better, too. So it seems like people are starting to buy services. You know, they put off going to the nail salon every week. They put off, you know, hiring someone to do their lawn. So now that they're feeling a little more flush, they're starting to return to some of those services. They're also going out to eat a lot more. Hmm. They're spending on experiences. So, you know, they're traveling instead of buying a gift. So they're still spending. It's just not on the traditional presents that you used to find, you know, under the tree.
Is that because people have enough sweaters?
You know, that's one argument. There isn't a strong fashion trend, especially for women right now, so there's no must-have gift. I mean, Star Wars will probably lift things a little bit, but I don't know about you. I'm not looking to get any Star Wars action figures this year.
No, nor am I. But do you think this is also perhaps a fallout from the recession, where people got burned and perhaps frightened so much that they're just being a little more careful, a little more cautious about what they're spending their money on?
We're definitely seeing that. The savings rate is up. People don't tend to buy as much on their credit cards. They're not running up the debt that they used to. They really are being more prudent with what they're spending on. And again, they are starting to spend more on services. So, you know, maybe they're getting their hair done more, or they're getting together with friends. It does seem to be an emphasis away from things and onto people, experiences, services. And that's really challenging for retailers. The other thing that seems to be a fallout from the recession is the focus on discounts. Consumers seem to be laser focused on getting a great deal. And that spans, you know, that's high end to low end. So, you know, no matter what you're buying or how much money you have, you want to feel like you're getting a great deal. And that can be really problematic for retailers who are trying to improve their profit margins.
Well, and you can go online to comparison shop, right, to figure out where you're going to get the lowest price.
Exactly. I mean, the biggest winner here is the consumer, because it's really easy now to see, if someone ripping me off, can I get free shipping from this retailer and not from that retailer? You know, it's definitely a buyer's market.
One more question about consumers. Are consumers also keeping their credit card debt down, not wanting to be burdened with those high interest rates?
Yeah, I think that we are seeing a little bit of that, too. And, you know, it's a time of caution and of wanting to save a little bit. You know, I have more money coming in, but I don't feel as wealthy, or, you know, it's sort of a wealth of effect. So people are definitely putting some away, because they know, we've seen from the recession, it can disappear.
And just how low can discounts get before it really begins to hurt a company's or retailer's bottom line?
Right. I mean, most of these discounts are planned well in advance. So retailers have said, you know, we're going to promote this much on these days. But if they don't see products start to move, they really get worried as it becomes later in the year. They can go pretty deep. And it's those unplanned discounts where you're cutting, you know, you plan to cut to 30% and maybe you cut to 40% or even 50%.
Wow.
That's what really eats into your margins because you didn't plan to sell that good for that much. And at a certain point, you might not be making any, like Black Friday, some of those doorbusters, you're not making money on some of those products. You're just trying to get people in the door and hoping that they'll buy a few other things.
Speaking of Black Friday, you've written about this, and are retailers rethinking opening, 6 o'clock on Thanksgiving evening, opening their doors to shoppers?
Well, there are still plenty of retailers who are going to be open, you know, right after dinner ends on Thursday. That doesn't seem to be a trend that's necessarily going to go away. But I think that there are fewer. I mean, there are definitely retailers taking a hard look at whether or not it's worth it for them to open. A good number of retailers have said, we're not going to open on Thanksgiving. You know, we tried it and it didn't work, or it's just not part of who we are. You know, it is really expensive to open on a holiday. You have to pay for additional staffing. You're paying them, you know, overtime or holiday rates. You have to pay for security in some cases. So it's not a cheap endeavor. And if you aren't seeing the traffic, then, you know, it might not be worth it. And there's the internet, you know, mm-hmm. You can offer those deals online and get a little PR boost from saying, you know, we care about our employees. We want to keep Thanksgiving sacred. But at the same time, come shop us online. We'll give you a great deal.
How about banking on Black Friday, you know, getting people to the mall, into the stores, getting some of those bargains? Is that still a play that retailers have?
You know, it's not as effective as it once was. We actually saw sales dip last year on Black Friday weekend, and it's because retailers are pulling those discounts forward. So more people did more shopping earlier in November. I mean, overall, the holiday sales grew by about 4% last year, which was the most in several years. But that Black Friday weekend was less effective as an actual event because we're so conditioned to get discounts all the time that we're going to buy when we see a good discount and not necessarily on Black Friday. I mean, you could wait till Cyber Monday and get something online, or you could come in on Thursday night.
What about small businesses? And I'm thinking of specialty stores, probably stores that have a loyal customer base. How are they faring in these economic times?
I mean, I think it's tough for them, too. So it's really all about, do you have the right product in your stores that customers want to buy that you can sell to them at full price? And it's been especially challenging, and we've seen it with the bigger retailers, but it's happening on the smaller end, too. If you want to start your own company online, your own retail business, it's pretty easy. The barrier to entry is fairly low. You don't even, in some cases, have to have inventory. So that's really taking a bite out of these more traditional, smaller and larger retailers. And, you know, it's kind of a death by a thousand cuts situation where no one company is taking all of their business, but it's all these other options. I mean, Etsy, Amazon started a handmade site. You know, there's all sorts of other places to shop now.
I mean, is it that people want a different shopping experience, a less tactile one, if I can put it that way, or even a less sensual one where you use your senses to see the stuff and touch it and feel it?
It seems to really be about convenience. Where is it easiest to buy? And online offers a lot of ease of convenience. You don't have to get in your car and drive to the mall and find a parking place. But at the same time, there's no one thinks that stores are going away. Shopping is still a very social experience for Americans. You know, it's a hobby for a lot of people. So maybe they're not buying as much as they used to, but they still like to go out in the store and look around, see what's there, try things on. But maybe they go home and actually make the purchase online.
I'm thinking about these smaller businesses. If you can't really have these dramatic discounts, you're just limited by that.
Right.
What do you do to get people in and get them shopping?
That's where it comes down to product. You have to have unique product, and you have to. That social media has been a big equalizer for those businesses because, you know, you can have a great social media presence and develop a huge following at relatively low cost just by building your brand through things like Instagram. And, you know, that's how some of these smaller retailers have really grown. I'm thinking of someone like a Brandy Melville, which became sort of a cult store among the teen and tween set. And, you know, it's pretty small. It's a small company.
You have to have pretty targeted advertising then, right?
Yeah, but, you know, targeted advertising, but also compelling content. I mean, these retailers are honestly being asked to become entertainment companies to some degree, have beautiful photos, have interesting videos, entertain me, and maybe I'll spend money with you.
What about the weather? We've had an unbelievable fall on the East Coast here, certainly in the Middle Atlantic, probably New England states as well.
Right.
You know, pretty much beautiful weather, rain that seems to come at just the right time. Does that affect retail sales?
Well, it really depends on who you ask. So Macy's definitely called out the weather and the warm fall as hurting their sales. But then you had someone like Nordstrom saying, you know, our coats did fine. Really, it was across the board. People just weren't coming in the stores and buying. So, you know, I think that the weather does play into it. You're probably less likely to go buy a winter coat if it's still 60 degrees outside. But you know, again, if you have a great coat at a great price, then maybe, you know, maybe people will come in and buy it. It's really hard to know how much the weather affects things because retailers will also blame the weather when it's too cold. You know, seems like an easy lever to pull to say, oh, it wasn't our fault. The weather was bad.
Well, yeah, I'm thinking, you know, snowstorms certainly don't get people in their cars and,
exactly.
and visiting malls. So what about the upcoming shopping season, December, November, big months for retailers? What is expected at this point?
They're huge for retailers, and I think we're looking at a really promotional season again. It's going to be all about the discounts, who can offer you the best price. You know, we've seen that for the last several years. That's really been the story. So I think, you know, in that sense, it won't be any different. And it's really going to be the consumer's going to have a lot of power to sort of decide what they want and how long they're going to wait to get the best price.
And some of these retailers, you know, basically sell the same stuff. I mean, they might have a different name on it, but essentially it is the same stuff. That's got to make competition even tougher.
Absolutely. It's definitely how can you differentiate yourself? And is it with, you know, ease of transaction? Is it, oh, I'm open earlier than the other guy? Or is it, you know, I'll offer you free shipping with no minimum purchase? There are a lot of different, you know, tactics retailers can use. But you really have to differentiate yourself because the customer isn't loyal. They're not looking, you know, they're not saying, well, I always shopped at Target, so I'll buy the TV there. They're saying, I'm going to go to who offers me the best deal.
It's all about price.
Right.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Lindsay Rupp in this first half of Radio Times today. She writes about retail for Bloomberg News, and we are talking about the fact that a number of retailers are struggling. They don't have the foot traffic that they rely on, customers using the internet and other sources in order to figure out what's the best price and what they want to buy. And it also looks like folks are saving money, perhaps spending money at restaurants and perhaps using their money to buy services. How do you spend your money? Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. We'd love to hear from retailers as well. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Despite an improving job market and an economy along with lower gas prices, it appears that shoppers are looking for deep discounts, maybe even buying less. And we're talking with our guest, Lindsay Rupp, a retail reporter for Bloomberg News, about these trends in retailing, what's making retailers nervous. And again, you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I mean, Lindsay, it sounds like this is a tough time to be in the retail business.
That's definitely true. It depends a little bit on who you are, though. I mean, it's been definitely difficult for some of the department stores, but, you know, not everyone's having such a difficult time. So, you know, again, it comes back to product, and do you have the product that people want, and, you know, do you have it at the price people want? And it seems like for companies like TJ Maxx, they're seeing real successes. They reported sales today that were better than expected. So it really depends on who you are and who you're selling to. to and what you're selling.
Are there geographic differences when you look at retailers and who's doing better and who's doing worse?
You know, we haven't really seen, I haven't looked at it at that level, but I haven't really noticed a difference in North America versus Europe. Yeah, there's a stark difference. You know, the U.S. with the strong dollar, we've seen a huge decline in tourism spending, which is big for companies like Macy's, like Tiffany, or some of the high-end players. They do a lot of business through tourists. Also in China, some of those high-end luxury retailers, they're seeing their customers buy in Europe instead of in China because the exchange rate's better, or they're buying in Japan instead of in Hong Kong because there's been a crackdown on sort of luxury goods. So there's definitely a geographical difference worldwide, but in North America, it just seems that people aren't that into apparel right now.
I remember a couple of years ago taking an elevator and with some, I think they were from England, some people just loaded down with packages, and they were coming to New York City of all places, even shopping in the sort of high-end parts of New York City, looking for bargains. And I guess with the dollar the way it is, we're not going to see that this year.
Yeah, there aren't a lot of bargains to be found if you're shopping in the U.S. from Europe or anywhere else.
Let me get Bill. Looks like Bill from Chester to join us on Radio Times. And Bill, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi there.
Well, as someone who doesn't shop, I'm only forced to travel around with my wife who does all the shopping, but I have a 15 or 20 year old sweater on right now.
It's, I bet you do,
a testament of how much I actually shop. But you know, we were in the Concord Mall last night in Delaware, and going through the Macy's there, I mean, there was just barely anybody in the store. And if you know the area, there's a Macy's in Springfield, Pennsylvania, down there in the Concordville Mall, and one at Christiana Mall, and all of these are within a half an hour of each other. So I don't know if that, you know, density of a retailer such as Macy's has anything to do with the foot traffic.
Well, Bill, it's a great question. Let me see what Lindsay Rupp has to say in response. Lindsay, go ahead.
It is an interesting question. And for a long time, retailers, the mantra was expand, 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 open more stores. And that's definitely not what we're seeing anymore. You know, retailers are starting to scale back. They're closing more of their underperforming stores, especially stores that are in malls that are maybe, you know, in the industry, they call them B or C level malls. You've probably been in them. They're indoor. They haven't been updated. They're kind of dingy. You know, people don't want to go to those malls anymore. They'd rather shop online or at an outdoor center. The mall really isn't what it used to be. You know, high-end malls are doing really well. Nicely maintained malls are doing really well. But we're seeing those mid and lower tier malls really struggle, and the retailers, you know, are struggling with them because the mall in general just doesn't draw the foot traffic that it used to. So they're having to get more creative with how to sell to those people if they're going to stay in that location.
And Lindsay, how much of a factor are the Bills of the world that hate shopping?
Yeah, you know, they're always trying to get you back in the store, Bill.
It looks like he's resisted for 15 years.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a real challenge for him. But, you know, they're trying to get you in with great product at a great price. And not everyone's going to succeed. And, you know, we might see fewer retailers as a result. It's always been a difficult industry. But lately, especially if you can't get customers in your stores, if you can't win over a Bill, that's a real problem.
An email from James. He talks about the fact that both he and his wife are self-employed. They make more than $67,000, so they don't qualify, I guess, for a health care subsidy. But basically what he's saying is that it's the health care costs that are eating into any disposable income that I might have.
Absolutely. We've seen that be a big trend, too. That kind of gets lumped in with the services. But, yeah, people are spending a lot of money on health care, and that you know, that money has to come from somewhere.
And looking ahead to the shopping season, the holiday shopping season, what is the National Retail Federation? What are they predicting? Is their track record pretty good as you look ahead, Lindsay?
Well, they're expecting us to have a pretty good Christmas, but growth will be slower this holiday season than in previous years. So they're calling for growth around 3%. It's kind of ranged in 3%. And that's lower than last year. Last year's growth was around 4%. So I think that they're trying to be realistic about what, you know, what people are actually going to spend on, and it might not be in the traditional retail categories this year. You might be giving a gift that's, you know, not a sweater or a gift card. And they've traditionally been fairly accurate. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
And if we're consumers, discount, 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 are there going to be bargains ahead?
Oh, yeah. Everywhere you look, there'll be a sale.
Well, on that note, Lindsay Rupp, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. She writes about retail for Bloomberg News, and she joined us from the studios of Bloomberg in New York. Well, the U.S. economy added 271,000 jobs last month, lowering the unemployment rate to about 5%. It looks like wages are on the upswing, with hourly earnings up about 2.5% from last year. All this could mean the Federal Reserve will raise interest rates, something they have been reluctant to do. Joining us to talk about jobs and wages, recovery, and interest rates is economist Mark Zandi. He's chief economist at Moody's Analytics, where he directs economic research, also co-founder of economy.com. And Mark Zandi, it's been a little while. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty. Good to be here.
Nice to have you here. You were listening in as I was talking with Lindsay Rupp about retailers and the fact that big retailers seem, and perhaps small retailers, saying that they're just not getting the foot traffic that they had hoped. What do you make of the fact that some of these stores like Macy's are saying, where are the shoppers?
Well, I think consumers are spending their dollars on other things, on services. I think you mentioned that. I heard a bit of the conversation.
Restaurants, hair,
travel, experiences. They're just not shopping as much in the malls and at big department stores. So it's not surprising that Macy's and Nordstrom's would have a bit of trouble. But if you look at consumer spending in total across everything we spend our money on, it's actually quite strong. After inflation, the growth rates are 3% plus, which is about as good as it gets. So consumers are out there buying. They're just not buying at Macy's and Nordstrom's.
Is retail, is that an important sector of the economy? We think of housing. We think of automobiles. Does retail play an important role if they are struggling? Is that going to have a ripple effect at all, do you think?
It matters, but spending at kind of the straight up department stores, I'm speaking from memory, so I've got the numbers. I don't have the numbers exactly right, but I'd say it's about 10% of the economy,
right,
something like that.
Right.
The rest of consumer spending is 50-60% of the economy, so it matters. I don't mean to downplay it, and certainly matters to those retailers, no doubt, and the people who work at those stores, but in the grand scheme of things, it's a small piece of the pie.
Last month, 271,000 jobs created in the month of October. People hailed this as good news. I think the official unemployment
rate. It is good news.
It is good news.
Yeah.
And the official unemployment rate, about 5%. What do you think explains the good numbers in October? Do you think those are sustainable numbers as you look into your crystal ball?
Yeah. In fact, we have been sustaining it. The average monthly job growth has been around 200,000 for the past three and a half years. You know, some months a little higher. Last month was a little higher. Some months a little lower. The month before in September was a little weaker. But, you know, abstracting from the month-to-month vagaries of the data, which are, affected by lots of things, we're creating 200,000 jobs per month. And, in fact, it's remarkably consistent job growth. You know, usually, if you look historically, job growth ebbs and it flows a lot. But in the last several years, it's been remarkably constant. And 200K is a lot of jobs. I mean, we created if you add it up over the last year through October, we created 2.7 million jobs. You want to guess the year, the last time we had that kind of job growth?
1957.
Oh, that's a good guess, but wrong.
I usually am when I ask questions like that.
Not bad. I don't know why you picked 1957.
I have no idea.
Yeah. Okay, 1999. Okay. And 1999 was the peak of the technology boom. And of course, that was a bubble. So we had a tech bubble that juiced things up. The current economy's creating these jobs based on good fundamentals. There's no bubbles out there.
And what kind of jobs are being created? And, of course, the follow-up question to that is, are these good-paying jobs? Are these minimum wage jobs or just a little bit above minimum wage?
Good question. When you create that many jobs, you're creating all kinds of jobs. Sure, lots of low-paying jobs in retail, leisure, hospitality. Those are low-paying. But a lot of middle-paying jobs. The construction industry is kicking into high gear. Just look at all the multifamily apartment buildings and towers that are here going up here in Philadelphia.
Absolutely.
That's happening across the country. K through 12, you know, government, which had been laying off during the recession early in the recovery, are now adding to payrolls again, finally. And a lot of high-paying jobs in the technology sector, professional services. So I'm in the professional services business. Business is strong, and we're adding aggressively to payrolls, and that's not – the only two sectors of the economy that are not adding to payrolls, actually laying off, and they're not really represented here in Philadelphia to a significant degree, is the energy sector. So, you know, oil prices have collapsed, which have been a boon to consumers, but it obviously crushes the energy sector. And the other is the trade-sensitive manufacturing sector, which goes to the very weak global economy and the very strong dollar. But most of those jobs are, you know, sort of in the Midwestern, southern part of the United States. So some here in the Philadelphia region, but not a lot.
One of the things I saw you note was that small companies are leading the way, that we're seeing growth in small retail, small tech companies getting started?
Yeah. Really, over the last couple of years, it's the smaller companies, those that employ less than 50 people, that have been most aggressive in their hiring. If you go earlier in the recovery back 5-6 years ago, it was mostly large companies. Mm-hmm. This is, I think, largely tied to that construction cycle. So, you know, housing-related, commercial construction. There's a lot of smaller businesses that are tied into that. And as construction activity has picked up, those small companies that are tied into that have done very well. Large companies aren't hiring as much because they're global, right? So they are selling a lot of what they produce to the rest of the world. The rest of the world is soft, and the dollar is strong, so they're selling less of what they're producing, and therefore they're not hiring as much.
Wages, broadly speaking, are ticking up. They have been – they're a little higher than they were last year. What explains that?
Yeah, finally, right?
Finally.
Yeah, finally. So wage growth has been pretty pedestrian. That's a good SAT word for you, by the way.
It is.
Yeah, pedestrian.
I'm going to remember that.
Okay, yeah. And 2%-ish kind of growth, which is about the rate of inflation. So people's after-inflation wages really have not been going anywhere for most of the recovery. That's finally changing. We are starting to see some pickup in wage growth above the rate of inflation, which is good. And it goes to the fact that we are creating a lot of jobs, and we are finally working through all those people that were unemployed and underemployed in the economy are now finding work. And as they get back to work, the labor market tightens. You mentioned that 5% unemployment rate.
Right.
That's a pretty good benchmark for an economy and a labor market that's getting pretty close to full employment. Once you're there, then workers have negotiating power, and they use that power, and they start to get bigger wage increases. And that's what we're finally starting to see, which is great news for the broader economy, for workers, and for the collective psyche. You know, I think a lot of people view the economy through the prism of their pay. And so until recently, they couldn't say much about that. But now, as their pay increases are increasing, I think they'll feel better about the economy.
I noted the labor secretary said, and I'm quoting here, wages are the unfinished business of this recovery. You agree with him?
Good line. That's a great line. It's the last thing to really kick into gear here.
Is that typical from a recovery from a recession?
Very, very, very much so, because it takes a while after the recession to get everyone back to work. And it's not until everyone's back to work at full tilt that, you know, wage growth really picks up. And, you know, I think what happens is, it's really, you know, businesses are reluctant, obviously, to raise wages. It's their cost. So they do, and once you raise wages, you can't take that. You will never take it back. So businesses do everything they can not to raise wages. You know, work at home, take the day off, how about lunch? You know, those kinds of things. At some point, those things don't work, and you start losing people. And it takes one company in each industry to say, look, I can't take this anymore. They raise wages. And then every company in that industry raises wages, and then you're off and running. So this is not atypical.
Let me ask you about that 5% unemployment rate. And those numbers, or how that's calculated, I guess, has come under some criticism, because there are certain people that do not get counted, that there are people in this country who have given up looking for work. They're not counted in that 5%, as I understand it.
That's correct. So to be counted as unemployed, you have to be looking for work. If you're not looking for work, you're not counted as unemployment. You're out of the labor force. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the keeper of this data, the government agency that collects this data, does ask people who have stepped out of the workforce, aren't looking, you know, would you take a job if you could find one, if one was suitable for your needs? And there are a fair number of those folks, much larger than has been the case historically. It's about 0.5% of the labor force. So that's part of the slack in the labor market that needs to get absorbed. And, you know, if we continue to create 200,000 jobs per month, which we have been over the past few years, and I think we will over the next year or two, will absorb those folks. They'll start coming back in. They'll find opportunities that suit their needs.
But should we count those people when we talk about unemployment, or does it make sense to just count the people that are actively looking for a job?
No, I think we should count. You know, those are people who say they want to work. They just can't. You know, they can't find a job that's close enough that makes any sense. Right? The commute costs might be too high. The childcare costs. But those are people who want a job if an opportunity appears. So we need to employ those people and provide them with opportunity. Now, the Bureau of Labor Statistics does you know, the number we all look at is the official unemployment rate. But there's other measures of labor market slack and unemployment that the BLS calculates, and it's available for everyone to see. And that includes these people who've stepped out. And it also includes those part-timers who would like full-time hours.
And what does full employment mean? And some have said with this 5% that we're, what, close to full employment?
Yeah, we're close. In fact, if we didn't have a lot of part-timers that wanted full-time work, and if we didn't have all these folks that stepped out of the workforce that say they want work, then I'd say to you today, Marty, we are at full employment. But we're not, because we have all those other folks that we need to absorb to get back into the workforce to work. And that's going to take another 6-9 months at the current pace of job growth to get them all back. So we're probably, you know, probably won't be to the summer 2016 before we're back to what I would consider to be full employment all in.
You're saying in the middle of next year we'll see full employment?
I think so.
In the United States of
America.
Here's
an intrepid forecast. July 2016.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're going to call you up.
Right.
We also have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Mark Zandi is our guest. He's chief economist at Moody's Analytics, where he directs economic research. We're talking about jobs and wages, the recovery from the recession. We will be talking about interest rates as well, and we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. We began our conversation talking about retailers working hard to get consumers in their stores, buying their products. Now we're talking about jobs and wages, the recovery. And our guest is Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics. And again, you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. So, Mark, with these good employment numbers, do you think the Fed is going to raise interest rates? They're meeting, what, in December sometime?
Yes. Yes, they will raise interest rates. Chairwoman Janet Yellen, the chairwoman of the Federal Reserve Board, in her speeches has made it pretty clear that it'd take an awful lot for them not to begin to raise rates in December. So I'd be surprised if they don't.
And once they do, and it's so interesting, whenever anyone at the Fed opens their mouth, the stock market goes bonkers, thinking, uh-oh, what, the end of all this free money we've been throwing around?
Well, actually, the market's kind of taken this pretty well, I think. I mean, the market stock market has basically gone sideways here this year, which is not all that surprising in the context of all the gains in the market. And despite this year's kind of softness, it's still very, very close to a record high. And this is very typical, you know, coming out of recessions, recoveries, the Fed ultimately decides to raise interest rates. And, you know, when you're in that period, the stock market kind of goes sideways. So this is very, very typical, something we've observed in past rate cycles. So I'm not at this point at all surprised by what we're seeing.
And who are the winners? If interest rates get raised, who wins that?
Well, in a very parochial sense, anyone who has, I'll tell you, my mother-in-law will be a winner. Well, you know, she's older, you know, in her mid-80s. And every time a CD rolls over, she calls me up and says, what should I do with that money? And I say, Mom, I'm not really
what
sure.
What kind of percent is she getting on that?
Well, and she goes, well, what do you do for a living?
But I'll let her deal with that
And I said, well, we won't go down that path any further. But anyway, so, you know, those folks, older Americans who shouldn't be taking a lot of risk, shouldn't be invested in the stock market, even shouldn't, you know, be in the bond market at this point, have a lot of cash, CDs rolling over, they'll start to benefit. But, you know, in a broader sense, look, a healthy economy, you know, zero interest rate, which is where we are, is not consistent with a healthy economy, right? So the fact that we're getting off zero and headed to something closer to normal, and there's a lot of debate as to what normal is, but it's 3.5% kind of interest rate. That would be more consistent with a well-functioning economy, economy that's operating at full employment. Everyone's working. Wage growth is strong. Labor's getting their fair share of the economic pie. So yeah, I think we want to see interest rates go back to normal because we want the economy to get back to normal.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation. We've got Alex joining us from media. And Alex, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
One was that I hear a lot of talk about college debt for students. I don't hear any talk at all about college debt for parents. So, you know, I just put two girls through college, and they graduated with quite a bit of debt. But we also pulled out of our 401ks and took on some debt as well. So that had certainly had an impact on us. And the second point that I wanted to make is that the salaries, both of the daughters have been position.
You know, Alex, I hate to do this to you. It's just a terrible phone line, but I'm going to read on the screen what you told our producer, asking, are wages increasing at all? Her daughter, who was hired a year and a half ago right out of college, has a starting salary of $25,000, which is terrible. And she also, Mark, talked about college debt, you know, young people starting off with a sizable debt over their heads.
Yeah, I mean, clearly the millennial generation has gotten crushed in this tough economy. The 20 to 35-year-olds, you know, they came into the economy looking for work at the very worst time. And of course, they did. Many of them did the right thing. They stayed in school longer, went back to school, raised their educational attainment to try to improve their earnings long run. But to do that, particularly in the context of the bad economy and the fact that house prices are down, people couldn't use their home equity and to finance their education, they used loans, student loans. And so it's, put them behind the financial eight ball. So this is a problem. Now, it doesn't matter, I don't think, to the economy in any given year, but this is a corrosive on the economy. It really weighs on this generation's ability to, you know, do all the things that we did when they were age.
Buy a house.
Get married, buy a home, start a family, you know, do all those things. The other thing that, and this is evidence coming out of research at next door here at the Philadelphia Federal Reserve, really great study that showed that student loan debt is affecting the ability of these millennials to start companies, right? So like when I started my company, I was 30 years old. And by that point, I had largely paid off my student loan debt. And moreover, I had 10 years of experience in the workforce, right? So I thought I knew what I was doing. I didn't, but I thought I did. But that was the fodder for starting a company. But these poor kids, you know, they haven't had that experience. They're just getting out of school, just getting going. And now they have the student loan debt. And it's really clear that this is really weighing on. So I think the student loan problem is a real problem and is going to weigh on our ability, our economy's ability to grow long run. And you know, frankly, I think we need to change the entire way we finance, help these kids finance college education. We're a long way from doing that, but we do need to do that.
In a nutshell, how could we do it better?
Well, you know, in my view, instead of taking taxpayer money and subsidizing student loans, which, by the way, there's also research that shows that what's happening is that colleges are just simply raising tuition to capture that subsidy. So these kids are on a financial treadmill, right? Take that subsidy and use it to increase the supply of educational services. So what do I mean by that? Well, you know, technical schools, community colleges, online education, you know, increase the supply so that it lowers the cost, or at least slows the rate of growth in the cost, so we have greater access to educational services. So we're working on – there's demand and supply, and we're working on the wrong side of the demand supply curves. We should be working on supply as opposed to trying to juice up demand.
That's interesting. Marco Rubio at one of the Republican debates said, we need more welders and less philosophers. The idea that welders make more money than philosophers, I don't want to get you too deep in that.
Well, especially since my son has a philosophy degree.
Is that true?
Right.
But what he seemed to be saying was we need more vo-tech,
look,
and things like that.
But we need a lot of everything, and we have room to employ gainfully people of all occupations. We need welders, no doubt. We need technicians. And I think that's why we should be investing in our technical schools, which we've kind of downgraded over the years. We're not really investing in that. We should. But we have plenty of room for professionals and philosophers, for goodness sake. Good ones. We need good ones, you know, lead the way for us intellectually.
Thinkers, right?
Thinkers, yeah. But and by the way, the thing that makes the United States great is that we do lead the world intellectually, right, on innovation, technological change, and all endeavors. And that is where our comparative advantage lies, and we should never give that up.
Let me see what Tom from Bucks County has to say. Tom, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning, folks. Thanks for taking the call.
You're
Appreciate
welcome.
That.
Sure.
I guess my main question is, and thanks for the input on the blue-collar workers. I'm all for that. We certainly need that. I'm encouraging my boys to go that route. But that wasn't my question. My question is the $15 an hour raise in the minimum wage. The argument there, of course, I watched a program last night. I tuned in late. PUC was interviewing folks that are arguing that, and they say that they're at $11, $10, whatever it may be, an hour. They struggle to make ends meet, and therefore they're on public assistance, which we all in turn pay somewhere online. Somebody's paying for that. So what is your take on raising it to $15, and how will that affect the economy?
Tom, thanks for calling in to Radio Times. Mark, go ahead.
Yeah, good question. So I'll say two things. First is that it depends on how high and how fast you raise the minimum wage. I mean, you know, if you raise it too high, too fast, and get minimum wages above just sort of general market wages, that can be quite counterproductive. Obviously, it will cost a lot of jobs. I'll give you an example. In Puerto Rico, and I just know this because they're going to default on their debt, their economy is a mess, they have a minimum wage that's tied to federal law, and it's too high for the market wages in Puerto Rico. Market wages in Puerto Rico are half those in the United States on average, and so that's costing a lot of jobs. So if you raise it too far, too fast, you've got a problem. You're going to cost low-wage workers jobs, and you don't want to do that. But the second thing I'll say is that if you raise minimum wages so that they're commensurate with market wages, don't get ahead of them, but are commensurate with them, I think generally what that does, it will cost some jobs, but on net, low-wage workers will benefit, that their incomes in total will be greater and that they'll benefit from that, and it's a plus for those workers. Now, I guess
like
I'll say—
$12 an hour? I mean, is there a target number you're thinking of?
Well, I think $15 an hour is reasonable, but if you phase that in over a period of 3 to 5 years, and the other thing I would do is, and there's legislation to do this, is index the minimum wage to inflation. Because, you know, what we do here is we raise it. It's not indexed to inflation. Of course, we have inflation every year, and over the years that erodes that purchasing power of that minimum wage. And so if we just indexed it to inflation, I think that would help these workers. It would be easy to plan against for retailers and leisure hospitality companies that are paying them, mostly paying the minimum wage. And it just be get us beyond this political battle that we have every 10 years over the minimum wage that is, I don't think, very productive. So I think there's a lot of things we could do to make this work a lot better.
I hate the fact that we talk about the working poor. And that we've got people that are working sometimes 2-3 jobs, and they can barely get out of poverty. They're still stuck in poverty.
Yeah,
I mean, that's got to hurt our economy.
I agree. And there's actually policies to address that that it has a lot of bipartisan support, and research shows works. It's called the Earned Income Tax Credit. So you're working, you can actually, if you work and your income is at a certain level, below a certain level, you can actually get if you don't pay income tax, you can get a refund check from the government. It's essentially incenting you to work and trying to get your income level up to address the concern you just expressed. And that that EITC, that Earned Income Tax Credit, has lots of support on both obviously the Democratic side, but also on the Republican side. And I think that's – if I were like king, I'd be more focused on that than on the minimum wage.
Let's talk a little bit about what's the terrifying and horrible terror attacks in Paris on Friday night, how that reverberates, I guess, across the global economy. It seems like a bit of a crass question, but nonetheless, these things have
an important one.
Have impacts. What do you see?
Well, it depends. Obviously, I mean, if the terrorism is isolated, we don't have a string of terrorist attacks. I think that the economy, the global economy, will be able to reasonably digest it, and it won't be disruptive to the degree that it you know, shows up in the economic data. Obviously, it's very disruptive to these communities and to these businesses that are affected. I'm not saying that,
right.
But in a broad macro global economic sense. If, however, you know, you have a string of terrorist attacks and they're not only overseas, but they're here in the United States, that's a different ballgame, right? And that's something that's going to be difficult for us. And this is the thing I've been, and I think many economists and policymakers have been fearful since 9/11. And, you know, what if we had that? You know, what would it mean for our economy? Now, having said all of that, I think we're an incredibly resilient people. You know, the Europeans, the globe, people are quite resilient. And, you know, ultimately we would adjust, but it would be a very painful adjustment.
A bunch of emails here. Email from Warren who said, we should remember that the minimum wage was never intended to be a living wage. It was just to be a pay level that stopped total abuse of employees by employers, never intended to be head of household pay scale. True?
Yeah, I think that's correct. You know, that's why there is a different movement that is centered around the idea of a living wage as opposed to a minimum wage. Historically, the minimum wage is, you know, just to make sure that people don't get, you know, literally abused by their employers, which is had been a problem historically. So I think that's true. But on the other hand, there's no reason why the minimum wage can't be used as a living wage if, you know, we decide that that's appropriate. And, I think many people think it is appropriate.
What about China? I mean, what role do you see China playing in our larger economy here?
Well, I think they pose the most significant threat to my optimism. You know, if
and you're generally an optimistic person.
Yeah, and it's worked out for me, Marty. Actually, I've been trying to cheer you up for the last several years.
That
I'm very skeptical. But here we are on the verge of full employment. Okay, so but you're absolutely right that I am generally optimistic, and I think. I'll say one thing and I'll say about China. Never bet against the American economy. I mean, that's you can't do that long for an extended period of time and do well in our 250-plus year history. Our history has been one of economic success, and I think there's no reason to believe that that will not continue in the future, just as long as we keep focused on the things that make our economy great. You know, the rule of law is very important. Yeah, you know, that we are open to other cultures, to immigration, to foreign investment, that we are leading the way for the global economy, and that we are welcoming to the best and the brightest from all over the world. I think, you know, we will continue to do very well on average. But, you know, right now our biggest problem here in the United States is that the rest of the global economy is soft, particularly China. China's growth rates have slowed, in part by design, but in part by the fact that they're trying to make these very big transitions from an export-led economy to a more consumption-led economy. They're trying to open up their financial system, which right now is very closed. They're trying to address big structural issues, environmental issues, and corruption issues. So they're trying to do a lot all at the same time. And that does create a lot of risk about their ability to manage the slowdown in growth. And obviously this year they didn't get it quite right, and that's why our economy hasn't experienced even stronger growth. I think they'll get it roughly right, but it, you know, I'm not saying that with a lot of confidence.
Well, on that note, always a pleasure. Mark Zandi, thank you so much for joining us today
on
Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. He's a chief economist at Moody's Analytics, where he directs economic research. And we began our conversation with Lindsay Rupp, and she writes about retail for Bloomberg News, catching up on things like the retail sector, jobs, wages, the recovery, and interest rates, covering a lot of issues in this hour of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. And you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back with Hour 2.